Hi, everyone. So I would like to get your attention after an amazing panel about art. That was so inspiring. Thank you so much for everyone who organized it and who participated in it. Now, this panel is about a conference that we have actually organized last year as an online panel and a book that's coming out of it. It's about anti-feminism and political homophobia. And unfortunately, as you know, the topic is still relevant, and some of the themes we have actually, the things that we have discussed already today about knowledge production in the academia, political values that we have, the ethics of activism, the matrix of power relations. So in the book that Tuna actually edited with Nadia El Ali and Kati Galor that's coming up, had some of the panelists here today. So I'm Gökçe Erdokul. I already introduced myself. And I'm doing this panel together with Aysat Adriling, who's... maybe you also introduce yourself.
Hello. Hi, I'm Aysat Adriling. I'm studying culture studies and art history at Humboldt University, and I work in this project with Tuna, Gökçe, and Inga. Yes, and I'm happy to moderate for the first time. I have all my notes here, so please be kind.
So the thing is, you know, when we were organizing this conference, I have been moderating panel for the 100th time probably, and Aysat is like student assistant, and she was like, I want to learn. Then I said, Aysat, now we do it together. So now, Aysat, you got to be careful what you wish. All right, so these are my opening words. So Aysat actually prepared an amazing script, runoff show, everything is perfectly prepared. And would you like to introduce the panelists, Aysat?
Yes, so this is Jamel Bouhari. He's a PhD candidate at the Institute for History at Leiden University. And besides achieving a master's degree in the interdisciplinary history program Governance of Migration with cum laude, he has worked in Amsterdam and Accra as a project manager, project coordinator and researcher at Dr. Monk, which is an international social innovation agency dedicated to systematic change in global inequality and sustainability. His academic interest lays on narratives of migration in the public and political, as well as in the intersection between LGBTQ+ history and African and Caribbean studies. With his current research concentrating on the queer sub-Saharan migrants in the Netherlands and the influence of homo-nationalism and the influence that homo-nationalism has on their lived experiences, we can be very happy to have you here. Next to you is Avadala. Avadala is a writer, activist, and psychosocial worker currently based in Berlin. Across Egypt and Germany, their work focuses on the intersections between health, sexuality, gender, and forest and migration through different approaches and interventions, including research, community organizing, and advocacy work. Avadala's writing explores queer intimacies, identities, and historical narratives, and has been featured in various publications as well as academic journals and anthologies. And recently, you've been accepted to the master's program Health History at the University of Glasgow.
Congratulations, Avadala.
Yeah. So, then we have Dr. Firozeh Farvardin. You are a postdoc researcher. It's weird reading that to you. Yeah. So you are a postdoc researcher working on gender sexual counter strategies of authoritarian neoliberalism at BIM and Her latest publication, titled Unveiling Women Protests in Contemporary Iran, Bodies, Narratives, and Performativity, is a good display of her academic interest in feminist theories and movements, gender and social politics, transnational mobility and mobilization, and the decolonization of knowledge production on these issues, particularly in the context of Middle East and Iran. Firozi is currently, along with other feminists from Latin America, Kurdistan, and Iran, co-curating a feminist festival called Beyond Equality, Feminism's Reclaiming Life, an internationalist gathering. And the event will take place at the end of the month at HAU. Yeah. And then, next to Götze, welcome Dr. Razan Ghazavi. Sorry. Dr. Razan Ghazavi, I practiced and I apparently couldn't, is an award-winning human rights defender and a postdoctoral fellow at the Forum Transregionale Studien EUME, which stands for Europe in the Middle East and the Middle East in Europe. Yeah, they received their PhD in gender and sexuality studies from the University of Sussex in Brighton. And while being a campaigner and activist, you are currently researching how notions of protests, violence, and political subjects have relied on heteronormative and binary logic that ignored non-binary forms of everyday protest. And this is a quote from your project, Carceral Geographies to Rationalize Borders, a Queer Feminist Ethnography. Thank you very much for joining this panel.
Thank you for being here. So we actually prepared a couple of questions and we gave them to you, of course, but I would suggest for the sake of time, we will ask one question and then we will open it up for discussion because we need to finish today at 17:55. So that we can give the floor to tonight for the closing remarks. So in a bit to like present your work, then I will go with the question for Firuze Filait. Too late during the day. Firuze, maybe you can discuss your work a little bit with us, and especially in the chapter that you wrote in the edited book on political homophobia, you talk about the complexity of hijab within metrics of power relations, especially the difference how hijab is perceived in Iran versus it's here. And you say that in the global north, and I really don't like these terms, and Sarah and I have been discussing it for a long time, global north, global south, the complexity of hijab in the global south is different from the global north. Can you please elaborate on that a little bit while explaining us your research?
Thank you very much. First of all, thank you for including me in this space and for having me here. And thank you for the questions. But to be honest, I kind of prepare myself to have a kind of explain a bit of context about my work and then kind of navigate to this question because I cannot jump a bit on this without explaining. But I will try to be really very quickly talking about that. It's very hard for me to kind of formulate, like find something in my works that are not fragmented or kind of link different things that I'm doing about migration or about gender politics in Iran. But what I found that is something that common among all things that I try to do and understand is the things that I, particularly as a migrant, I kind of encounter here. Some of you kind of explained very beautifully about different of the things that I'm going to talk, but I'm talking from the different perspective, I would say that. And this is the things of that I call, and I actually borrow from my colleague and friend, Damir Arsanovich, that talking about experience of the himself as a queer Muslim during the war, Yugoslavian war. And what he explained about that, how he faces of epistemic violence when kind of the come to the academia here in Europe and then kind of the face this kind of the ethno-nationalist framing of the what's happening there. And the kind of the, that's the reason that I got this kind of a concept of epistemic violence that is not, of course, new, but in a sense to talk about different experience that I have in the margin of the Northern, or I don't know, Western academia, and my own experience being in German academia. I don't have time, of course, to talk about what I mean about this in a different aspect, about this specific narrative that kind of the impose on the way to knowledge produce about Iran, that geography that we know as Iran, and also how it's politically consumed about that country. But I would say that the same thing's going on for the hijab politics when we are talking about, I kind of experience the same violence, epistemic violence, when we are kind of the facing this question of the hijab politics. So I try to kind of elaborate on that a bit based on the, my own experience. A month before the all things happened in Iran, the revolution movement that actually triggered by the, you know, the hijab police kind of the beaten and killed a Kurdish woman in Iran. A month ago, before that, in Taz magazine in Germany, there was a article published by the journalist, famous journalist, apparently feminist journalist, that working as a correspondent in Lebanon, about about hijab politics in Iran and how it's actually a kind of the white feminist projection that hijab is an important things and political things for the all the Iranians there, and. Actually, she was just discussing the issues by talking with the German and white feminists here, and they kind of accused them of the this kind of projection about you know, kind of the anti-Muslim reaction. I mean, she was just talking about this kind of anti-Muslim sentiments here regarding the issue of hijab, without even mentioning the context that she's talking about, that is Iran. She never even mentioned what's happening in that country. The only example that she said about the experience there in this article is about the Algerian War of the Independence and how it's kind of the, and also kind of the post-colonial rhetoric about the, this white man wants to kind of the save the, women's there in Algerian War of Independence, without kind of even considering herself part of the people that now trying to kind of save Iranian women that living there. So basically, don't kind of consider their agency there. To be honest, I never had such an experience in my life that when I was in exile, feeling that have a racist attack, because I really thought that my experience, not only as a someone live and experience beaten and lashed as a, because I don't have a proper hijab in that country, kind of ignored and kind of the relatively talking about it's part of their culture, or this kind of the, you know, this kind of the way of talking about the issues. And for me, it's a kind of epistemic violence to, and it's to my account is related to the problematizing one here without considering the consequence, political consequences for there. So this kind of the political, I don't know, the kind of the geographical spatial hierarchies, and I would call it political space, I think is very things important that we should kind of the consider in our works about where are we are and for whom we are kind of knowledge, producing knowledge, and what would be the consequences of so knowledge production about specific context that we are talking about. So I think with this note, I can finish this talk.
Thank you, Firuze. Your turn, right?
Yes. Thank you very much. That was very inspiring. Jamil, maybe you could also elaborate a little bit on your work and on the influence that homo nationalism as a concept in the Netherlands has on the sub-Saharan queer migrant.
Yes, yeah. Thank you. Hello. Yeah. Thank you. And also thank you for your introduction. So I'm Jamal Buhari and I work at Leiden University. I do my PhD in my first year, so I still have a few more years to go to finish. But yeah, in my project, I look at queer sub-Saharan African migrants in the Netherlands. And in this research, I look at migration motives, expectations, trajectories, and lived experiences. As you mentioned already, I do my PhD at the History Institute. So I do look at the period from 1980 to present, so quite a recent period. And I take the 80s as a starting point because of some legal changes in the early 80s, so the widening of the refugee definition, which, for example, made it possible for people to gain refugee status based on their sexual orientation or gender identity. Of course, as I said, I look at sub-Saharan African queer migrants, which is a large, diverse world region, so I do have a selected few countries of origin that I look at, selections based on some criteria. So I include a few countries that have recently introduced further criminalization. So that includes Uganda, also Nigeria, from which there have also been rather visible queer migrations or migrant communities in the Netherlands. I also include countries that already had larger diaspora communities in the Netherlands. So that includes Ghana, which is one of the biggest sub-Saharan African communities in the Netherlands. Also Cape Verde, so a very different context, very big community, diaspora community in the Netherlands as well. And then I include Zimbabwe, so Southern African country, which is a country that also gained a lot of media attention and attention from a lot of LGBT organizations, well, in the Netherlands, but also in other parts of the world. Especially because of some of the statements that former President Mugabe made, some very homophobic statements. So those are some of the countries of origin that I include. In this research, I do have a few focus domains that I look at. So I look at developments in the policy and asylum domain and changes throughout time, but also personal experiences around those systems. I look at organizational infrastructures. In the Dutch context, there's some very big, you could say mainstream LGBT organizations that have existed from the early 20th century and continue to exist till today. Of course, there's also newer or different kinds of groups, more migrant-led initiatives or queer migrant organizations. So I also look at this kind of infrastructure in the Dutch context and how this changed or how people have access to these different support networks or communities. And then I also look at media and media framing, but also representation that people might have access to. And with this research, I also sort of critically analyzed the Dutch self-image because the Netherlands really has a strong self-image of being a very tolerant nation, being very open. I think it has this reputation, but also a strong self-image. And I sort of, critique this or critically study this by shedding light on experiences of queer migrants of color in this context. And part of this research is also looking at how, of course, the Netherlands has a very long, has a colonial a history of colonization that has a modern-day legacy. So I also look at how that plays out in modern times and how that influences lived experiences of queer black migrants, both within wider Dutch society, but also within LGBTQ plus scenes. And as you mentioned, I also look at the role of homonationalism, which is looking at the Dutch context, a more recent development, became very widespread, especially in the early 21st, or the beginning of the 21st century, with some openly gay Dutch politicians who really pushed this narrative of a certain pro-gay and especially anti-Islam rhetoric. So I also look at how this impacts migrants and specifically also sub-Saharan African queer migrants. So that's sort of in a nutshell my research, what I'm currently working on.
Yeah, thank you so much for presenting this and also for doing this research. I hope to read it one day. And now I would like, Avadala, maybe you could present also your work and your thoughts on this panel.
Yeah. on this panel in general, so I have some thoughts about that. Thank you for the question and thank you for having me here. I'm excited to be here, even though I know everybody's exhausted and tired now. And actually, I want to reflect on this moment because I have moved to Berlin in 2014, and I have witnessed the rise of a category of called queer refugee. I was the queer refugee, but then people were talking about us, deciding about our lives, and then eventually researching us, now we are in this moment where we are in a conference about queer migration. So I want to acknowledge all the queer migrants and especially the queer refugees for making this also happen. I definitely have an interesting relationship also with producing knowledge. I remember, I think I wrote a blog post in 2009 about an incident of homophobic violence in Cairo. And that was actually a beginning of my writing practice that evolved from, blogging to journalism to now contributing to academic spaces as well. And it feels kind of like a full circle moment somehow, especially that I'm going to Glasgow this year to begin my grad school journey. So a lot of people have apologized about taking a lot of space, but I don't feel apologetic about it at all. It's time for me to take space and to be producing the knowledge myself because it's always been done about us. A couple of years ago, Tunay Gökçe organized a conference on queer feminist critiques, and I contributed with a paper which has developed now into a chapter that's coming up soon in Edinburgh University Press publication. And basically, it's coming out from my experience of the pandemic, being a queer exiled person living through the pandemic. And feeling a lot of the time was like, why does this feel so much like being in Egypt? Why is it so much throwback Egypt happening? Obviously, after the Egyptian revolution, we have lived through lockdown experience. So that state controlling our movement and who gets to meet whom and where. But also, I, as a queer person, I always felt this sense of prosecution. That was kind of emerging again in the pandemic. I felt queer intimacies were illegalized. Us getting together, interestingly, it was emerging in ways that are kind of older. So people were doing raves, spontaneously, something that is not regulated, something that is not part of a capitalistic structure, but people just coming together in a park to be together and have fun. And I found that very exciting. I found that reminding me a lot of my experience in Tahrir Square because the police was chasing us and I was like, oh yeah, that feels like Egypt. So that really was beginning my investigation into the moral panic that is something that happens a lot in Egypt, that the state uses its machines to create a moral panic to distract from economic and political issues at the expense of queer and trans people. And then I witnessed that this is happening in Germany, but nobody's calling it moral panic, or nobody's talking about how the media is also implicit in creating the moral panic, or how the state security apparatus is being violent and oppressing queer people. And especially with the health rhetoric, because we were in, I compare this situation that happened in Hazan Haida with the raves that was going in there with a case study of Egypt that a bathhouse was raided in 2014. Also after a media report that was an undercover media report, which is really the same thing that how Hazan Haida actually started. There was an undercover media report penetrating the space and making it public. All of this is under the rhetoric of public health. So in Egypt, the media report was about, oh, we need to stop this HIV disaster that because these people are having sex without condoms, which was kind of similar to people saying here, all these like queer people coming together without masks, and you know, we need to stop this, they are the reason. And that's exactly a moral panic, because the people were exaggerating the harm and the actual concern of what was going on. So yeah, it was interesting for me. I was saying something that's controversial, but it felt like public health with the new national security. And it was this thing that, you know, like there is this surveillance and control and violence. And I had all those questions of like, should the police be the one enforcing public health policy? Is the media in Germany actually liberal and free? Is this country actually, you know, liberal as it presents itself, or is also a deeply patriarchal, sexist, and homophobic and transphobic, racist, and all the stuff? So, yeah.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad that these questions brought you here and that you are able to maybe answer some of them together with us. I would also, Razan, like you to present your work.
Thank you, Aysata and Koshke, for these questions. And also, I'm really grateful to be part of this panel. Like, this is my second time with Fairuze, and it's my first time with Awad Allah, and it's also my first time with Jamil. So I'm really grateful, and sounds amazing, fascinating work. I can't wait to like talk more about this. So I'm just gonna give it like briefly talk about my work. I'm kind of like, I did my thesis, and now I'm kind of trying to still think in my new research, but I don't think I had enough time to think about it, honestly, because I've been like applying for jobs and like surviving winter in Berlin. But now it's the summer, it's nice. So now it's time, and this is really encouraging to kind of think loudly with you all. So I'm really interested in what I did in my work and my postgraduate studies is that I was really interested in kind of the idea of coming back from the revolutions, like in the Syrian context. I was really interested in the idea of who is a political subject. So who is a revolutionary? Who is not a revolutionary? And who gets to decide? And also, what is a political violence? And my work is really trying to kind of reframe the mainstream revolutionary context in Syria by bringing queer theory and specifically queer of color critique. And I'm kind of like, I know I did a PhD on that, but I feel like I still need to kind of think more about queer of color critique. So I was really happy that I'm starting like yesterday, especially like in the talk with Fatima and others, they talked a lot. And also Jen, I'm not sure if Jen is here, but they talked a lot about queer of color critique, and that was refreshing for me because, yeah, I'm still figuring that out. But so what I did is that I did an ethnographic research and auto-ethnographic research in Syria and Lebanon. And what I did is that I interviewed people in Lebanon, Syrian and Palestinian self-identified LGBTQ refugees, artists, teachers, students, and activists. And what I did is that I followed their journey from Syria to Lebanon, but when I started my fieldwork, I was focused more on Syria. I was not really interested in Lebanon. I was just like really interested in the idea of how did you experience the revolution and how did you experience the state's war against the revolution and the people who revolted in Syria. So through the interviews and ethnographic research, a lot of people told me about checkpoints and how they crossed checkpoints and how they did not cross checkpoints and they ended up in prison. So checkpoints and prison became part of my understanding of political violence against people who are not framed as activists. So they're not framed as political activists, they're not framed as politicians, they're not even framed as revolutionaries. So I that's why I was like, so who is a political subject and who decides? So this is why I'm kind of my understanding of a political subject is those who defy the state and the authority. And for me, crossing a checkpoint and navigating prison, that involves a lot of defying of militarization of the state, also defying the militarization of the revolution. So I kind of like talk about all of these things. I know that seems a lot, that's not a very good way of talking about my research, but yeah, this is what I'm doing. And this is what I did in my postgraduate studies. Right now what I'm doing is that I'm kind of, this is why my postdoc research was like from carceral geographies to racialized borders. I'm kind of interested in thinking about how border becomes also securitized. So like thinking about the carcerality of the borders and how also people like suddenly become racialized by crossing the borders to Germany or like crossing the borders to Europe. And I'm also interested in like understanding how people understand this racialization. How do they frame it? How do they see it and how they navigate it? But that's when I was not able to do any work because everyone in Berlin in winter, they don't want to leave home. They don't want to see me. They don't want to even know me. And now I feel like I'm starting to do my research. So we'll see how that goes.
Thank you for, so we got a little bit of more time. Thank you for that. So we will finish at 18:15 for your information. And I'm seeing a lot of overlaps with the previous panel when Ahmed was talking about how people become different people when they cross borders, for example, what you just said. Also, the sort of like autoethnographic research we call in sociology, and Jaran was also doing with their own work with the photo book, and the kind of political violence of the state that Ruzgar was talking about with the envelopes coming in and Herr Frau, like creating a sort of state terror at home. So it's also resonating with the art. But as I also observe and your trajectories over the years, especially Awadallah's and Firuze's, I met Awadallah a couple of years ago, and so they came to give a talk at the Humboldt University. And then we had a little coffee chat, and Awadallah said how uncomfortable they are in being in an academic space. Now he's going to academia. So I want to now challenge you to talk about your activist selves and the academic knowledge production. And if this is, are you laughing at me? or Awadallah? In Turkish, they call it Kürdünya Larsen. Okay, Awadallah. So I want to ask you the combination and the challenges of being an academic and activist at the same time. I mean, I'm going it through myself. So, you know, I just want to get some tips from you how to overcome this identity crisis.
Wow, that's an exciting question. I feel I have this interesting positionality towards academia because, you know, I mean, I went to a university to do my bachelor in my hometown, which is a small town in south of Egypt that is marginal by Egyptian standards. I was thinking a lot about this because, you know, I was actually now, I feel like, you know, I'm really closer to the gates of academia than ever before since I'm about to begin my grad school. So it has been a very long, you know, relationship. Mostly because I moved to Cairo. After that, I started to work on issues of gender and sexuality. Using my health background, I like to talk about sex, so I decided to become a sex educator. Like to combine my passion and my, you know, my skills. But I realized that also being like doing this role means that you will perform a lot of care work. because when you are a vocal person in a community talking about these issues, it means that people will talk about sexual health issues, so people will come to you and then also address issues of sexual violence. So this became really my work, but then this meant that also I became the interest of academic research, because I was a queer person in a revolution, because I was a person read as male in feminist organizing. I was later then a refugee, a queer refugee. So there was always this interest, and me personally, I'm interested in writing just because it was, you know, what I knew already from it as a child. Okay, I have a lot of secrets, and a lot of queers know that, and there's no way to talk about them, so I will write them down. So I had this, you know, this. There are some, you know, people who want to express themselves and want to write about the world, and also I feel like being a queer exiled person, the lived experience is usually against the mainstream narrative. The experience of a revolution, my own perspective of it is different from how people talk about it. This refugee crisis, is how it's talked about, is completely different from my narrative. So I had this, like, sometimes I realized that without actually consciously doing it, that I'm writing a very specific, narrow, knowledge that is not mainstream, that is not well known. So there was always this tension, because a lot of academics wanted to, you know, like, work, and I did that because, you know, I believe in knowledge production as well. But of course, after some time, I was getting frustrated with how this process also contributes to an unequal kind of labor. Because sitting with somebody and giving an interview means that you're sharing your emotional labor, because of course it usually involves a lot of difficult and traumatic experiences, but also contributing intellectual labor, because you're basically contributing your analysis in your way of seeing the world. And often that is not really kind of reflected in you know, how you're acknowledged, because also most of the time you actually have to be anonymous. So you're just in a footnote in a book somewhere, and your work is not acknowledged. So that's why there is this tension. I don't really know how it's going to be. I mean, I of course, one of the things is, you know, being, I don't know if I can still use killjoy, but because I also like joy, but I don't know. I think there will always be this tension because of our own positionalities, means that it's politics or being political or being activistic is not a choice. It's always something that I will have to do just to ensure my dignity and the dignity of the people that I care for or the community that I call home.
Thank you very much. It's kind of the challenging questions. Continuing regarding what I already said, I want to say that, okay, so we are kind of, or at least I kind of acknowledge this kind of the epistemic violence, and I think the things that I can do, and strategically I think is very important, is for me, at least in case of Iran, try to de-exceptionalize the context. I mean, if there is a kind of the step toward changing knowledge production, is to get a space and then change it. So in this sense, it's important to be in the field. So basically using Razan's thing, talking about privileges, bringing in the front line, I would say that this is the things that is important for me. And in different ways, I try my best to kind of, at least in the case of knowledge production, about and through Iran to de-exceptionalize when we're talking about there. So we are always talking about universality and universalizing, generalizing. That is also the other side. of this story that is we should kind of criticize it. But actually, I learned from the queer theory and queer perspective that de-exceptionalizing is also another way of dealing with the issue. So, for example, in my work, the current ongoing work that I'm doing about contentious politics in Iran around the gender politics, basically, I'm working on the current revolutionary movement in Iran. I try to kind of now use this idea of de-exceptionalizing by actually focus on the transnational trends, transnational aspect of what's happening currently in Iran and how this affects transnational spheres as well. So in a sense, of course, there is a specific particularity about the case of compulsory hijab in Iran, but we cannot answer that why does a specific moment in the history of Islamic Republic, this revolutionary movement happened, not any other time, because, I mean, in 1980s, it was even worse than now. 1990s, it was different. So there are different way of policing gendered bodies and hijab in Iran, but why this happening right now, my argument is that it's related to neoliberal turn and a kind of neoliberal kind of gender politic, anti-gender policies all around the world. So there are many similarities rather than differences. I would say that, of course, as I said, that there are some specific unique aspect, but we are kind of witnessing a trend here, there, and everywhere about this kind of a turn toward authoritarian neoliberalism and its gender aspects. It's very vividly anti-feminist and anti-gender aspect. So this is the things I try to kind of to somehow do. Of being in academia as much as possible.
Thank you. Would you like the author as well? No, the production in the academia and your activism.
Yes. For me, I would say I think my motivation to be part of this or to work on this project was based on my political values, I would say. So I tried to bring that into the project, but yeah, I would say that it can be a bit of a weird experience being in these academic settings. I've also noticed lately that I get, I get questioned more sometimes about my own, it's my own positionality, but more in a way of like, oh, how are you like objective, which, I mean, nobody would be. I've had that question a few times, and I think it's, I assume that researchers of color, or then queer researchers of color as well, would get these questions more often. That's something that I do notice that I experience more. But other than that, I feel like I do bring my own sort of values and activist ideals in the research that I'm working on. So,
yeah. I don't know who I said this to, but I think that was like in 2018 when I said this was. I was in a conference in Lebanon with some colleagues, and I said, it's a shame that there are many of my ideas cannot be discussed in my activist movement, but I find no other way to express them except in academia. And I said that because I think Awadallah said something about like this idea of like we feel so much estranged by how revolution's been talked about. And for example, in the Syrian context, I was against, later on, I was against militarization and sanctions and like this whole alliance with Turkey and sometimes Israel, and also with the Gulf countries. So all of these issues, I had really difficult time to navigate within my movement, that I think I was then categorized as an Assadist and as someone who's now changed my activist ideals because I'm now, I disagree with the movement or what the movement wants. So I did not find any, so I don't know how to answer that question because it's not a binary, right? Like activism and academy is not a binary. And I think sometimes you have really like a dangerous gatekeepers in the movement itself and the activist movements. Sometimes or always, I don't know. But I feel like that's what I was dealing with. And I think I decided to, you know what, fuck this. I'm queer. I don't even care. So I this was my idea of like, you know what, I'm done with your movement. I'm done with your revolution. I'm just going to claim myself as queer. I'm going to move on. And that's when I decided to do my PhD on queerness. And I moved on, and now that's why I'm like grappling with the idea of political subjectivity, political violence, and the question of exile. But also, like, of course, we're not romanticizing academia, but also like in this space, we can find people who can we work with, and that's a way of like doing counter, you know, kind of. I don't know, I don't want to say movement because I don't think there's going to be a movement in academia. But I mean, let's just say like counter-archive, you know, like counter-archive, counter, I don't know, community, whatever. So like how to be against establishment, how to be against the management that is beginning paid a lot of money that staff are now striking all over like Europe. And I'm coming from the UK, like all my universities now striking against their management. So I guess... I think I don't know if I answered your question.
Thank you so much. We are sharing one microphone, so so the script I am not following the script. I can't even like follow like when I am cooking. I can't even follow a recipe. Forget about following a script. I want to ask Rezan a question, if you don't mind, after what they just talked about. If you don't mind, and then we can open it for the discussion. Is that okay? So, also, you know, this art panel really moved me. So I'm also constantly thinking about them and thinking about what you just said. There are multiple exiles, unfortunately. And perhaps this is also resonating with you because you're also nodding your heads. It's going to be like a Sezen Aksu song, but it's like, you know, whenever you are in exile, I am again in exile all the time. Like, it's almost like I'm carrying the exile with me. Can you say a few things about these multiple exiles? And I especially felt this when scholars at risk from Turkey started coming to Germany. And they created, you know, in sociology we call it transnational spaces, but it's actually a form of an exile within an exile. And also the, you know, German media was exoticizing them. They were saying like refugees, academic refugees, they are coming to Germany and stuff like that. And they were always trying to say, you know, we are scholars at risk. We are not academic refugees to Germany. And they were comparing to Jews who went to Turkey and all these kind of things. So, you know, these multiple exiles and exoticization of the exile through the German discourse. Can you a little bit elaborate on this? I have a feeling like with this counter-archiving and the exile point, you have a good insight on this, I have a feeling. And if you don't mind, then we'll open it for discussion.
Thank you. I don't think I can talk about the German context. I am not here again. I wasn't here a long time ago. I think I just came last October, and I'm leaving in 2 months. I can say something maybe briefly about multiple exile. I think I'm now realizing that I've felt as an exile in Syria, as a Syrian Palestinian myself, and I've always like navigated spaces like, am I Syrian? Am I Palestinian? I don't feel like I'm Syrian. I don't feel like I'm Palestinian. So I've always had this very kind of difficult, and being queer on top of all of this is also like didn't help to kind of like find my roots or my tribe. So I feel like that's what draw me into the literature on Iraqi Jewish literature. And this is my first kind of study. Is also they navigated this idea. You know, after nationalist movement in the region, a lot of intellectuals, Jewish intellectuals, Arab Jewish intellectuals, they went to Israel, and they kind of like fled there because there's a lot of persecution against them, And a lot of them did not feel Israeli, and at the same time, they had a really contestation with that, with their home country. So they talked about this in their work, and they talked about it in this literature, and this is what draw me into their work, is the idea of non-belonging, of navigating different spaces. So I think that's my first experience with exile, but then I shared a lot of exile. I'm sorry I disappoint you. I don't have like other answers,
no,
but maybe
absolutely.
Others
brilliant.
Can have.
Any of you would like to say anything, contribute to this, non-belonging? Non-belonging, everyone?
may I say something, if you don't mind? I mean, back to my experience, I just want to add something regarding the, actually about Berlin and, you know, being, I'm kind of new in being exiled, so I'm a self-exile person after the revolution, so I kind of decided to not back, to be more public, to talk about what's happening there, so it's my situation, but the things that is interesting for myself is that my relation with Berlin is now changed. Now I kind of see after a long time, more than 8-9 years that I'm living in Berlin, I have a different relation all of a sudden. Also, I'm also now German, recently also. But my relation with the city is really completely in this kind of the 9 months change. And there are different, I would say that reason for that. One is that it's become also the streets of Berlin now is for me has different meaning because there are kind of the many protests happening in support of Iran demonstration that kind of has the different meaning for me of the past. And in the sense also different placing has different meaning for me. About the past of the city, I have now looking more to return to the past of the city to read more about the peoples in exile, particularly Middle Eastern in exile and Iranians in exile, because it actually Berlin is the, now there is the Middle East in exile, you know that from the, I mean, after these 10 years, and many of us has this experience, but also for a long time history, Berlin has this kind of the history. For example, for Iranians from the Weimar Republic up to now, there are many diaries and kind of the stories of the hope and despair being in this space. So now for me it's different looking back to the archive and you know, maybe something come out of it. A kind of archive of being in exile. So I just want to add that, yeah, this.
Thank you. Do you want to moderate, Aysata, or how shall we do it?
There was an exchange of mics, but yes, so I would have one more question, or we could open it to the public, so to the audience. So I would say, do you have any questions?
Do you have any questions? We have 15 minutes for discussion.
Thank you very much. My question is, basically for every one of you, because since you are at a different stage of your career, research career, including moderation. So I am just wondering, to what extent do you draw the line, or how do you position yourself in terms of what you want to be active against, or what you want to be actively fighting for, in terms of, for example, logistically in the office, everyday office, or choosing your academic research topics. And these are things that will not go away. They're always there. So how do you, I think it's a little bit related to what Gershit talked about the sustainability. How do you kind of make it work? And also, how do you position yourself in terms of to what extent do you want to preserve the most of it, the most of queerness, the most of the diverse perspectives? Yeah, if that is clear enough.
Thank you so much, Sinhao. Shall we take a few questions?
Hi, can I go?
Jennifer?
Yeah, thank you. This question is for Awadala, although I understand if they don't want to answer it here. because the comments about the pandemic really got me thinking. We've been thinking, I think, when it first started, I think you wrote me and said, because I was working in politics and I had a lot to do with the pandemic. I remember Awadala saying to me, please don't outlaw queer sex. Mm-hmm. I was just kind of wondering, if we look at the pandemic as kind of like a so-called state of exception, is a metaphor for how particular bodies are exposed to state violence all the time. That's a very, like, on the very harsh receiving end of a necropolitics that doesn't go away at the end of the pandemic. I was just wondering, how do we kind of think through solidarities with maybe other groups, people who are clinically vulnerable, for example, in the pandemic, where I was kind of really horrified to see anything good disappear from the public health system and just allow old people to die or clinically vulnerable people to die. And I was wondering, like, how do we think through these solidarities going forward?
Thank you. We'll collect and then come back.
Hi, this is a question for Firozeh and Ruzgar from the art panel, if he wants to get involved. I actually want to pick up in the non-belonging part as something personal, but also something that I see around happening quite a bit. As Ruzgar called it, contemporary Germans. I'd like to borrow that term. Yeah, the hair flip, exactly. And Firozeh, you also said that I'm a self-exiled person, right? So my question is, it's tough to be this self-exiled person or contemporary German because I do not embody, as I myself am a German, I do not embody what is understood under Europeanness or what it means to belong to Europe. I think Fatma El Tayyib will be able to tell more about that. Not going into there, but maybe to just hear from your lived realities and experiences. You say that Berlin's past, it has a huge past, and I actually want to address that in order to go to the future that awaits us contemporary Germans, let's say, and also to tie it to the first panel, where Jenner, I think, talked about hope and future and how that too also, you know, the neoliberal approach to hope and future and how that sometimes is a bit naive in that sense. I quite struggle with it. Now, coming to the crux of my point is, as a contemporary German, there's a huge archive. Germans are quite good at it, archiving things. You know, I am at the theological faculty here at Humboldt, and I just attended an excursion to Rhine, Mittelrhein, medieval castles, and all of these old books that have, you know, Latin and all of those very, very precious things there. And it's hard to come in terms with that German-ness, being that German, and all those people who have lived before us and call themselves Germans, and me, you know, just kind of swinging it around, and I don't know where I belong, how should I move forward. Also, just academically, I sometimes feel quite lost. So maybe just from your experiences, or whoever wants to share theirs, to, you know, share, I guess. Thank you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Any others from the floor? There's one more on there.
Yeah, thanks for your panel. It's really interesting. I'm also interested in the question of activism. I mean, I thought it was interesting that you mentioned that there are gatekeepers within activism, and I was also like, it was good to hear that you mentioned that activism is not a choice. So I was just wondering, within academia, I mean, academic work and just trying to, you know, move up after postdoc and getting that professorship, I mean, it's quite time consuming, and so is activism. So I was wondering, how would do you see yourself sustaining it? I mean, academic writing, I mean, in journals now they are more and more accessible, open access, but, you know, being on the streets or organizing or doing workshops and all that's. So I was just wondering if you have a strategy or if you've thought about it, you know, how to keep both going and not falling apart.
Yes, that's right. Thank you. And Rezan has a question for?
Jamel.
And then you have 5 minutes to answer all the questions.
I actually wanted to ask Jamil, I don't know if you're pronouncing your name right, but actually it was when you said, you talked about Hmu nationalism, I was really interested in what you thought about what's written about Hmu nationalism right now, and whether you agree or disagree, what you thought about it, like, because you're bringing it into your work, and I was interested in and hear your thoughts about it.
That was good from the... Okay, excellent. So we have 5 minutes. Are there any other questions? If not, then we have 5 minutes to answer the questions. I suggest that you pick and choose the questions that you would like to answer. Jamal, would you like to start?
So you suggest your question was on what has been written on Hmu nationalism, or what I think of... Yeah. So what I've been... or I kind of noticed that I've initially mainly focused on the Dutch context and focused a lot on Dutch literature and on Hmu nationalism, which makes it seem as if it was a bit unique to the Netherlands, but also now being in Berlin, I don't think it is. So I think I should expand myself more, maybe to also look at other European contexts and see whether this Dutch Hmu nationalism, well, I don't think it is unique, but there might be certain characteristics that are unique to it. But that was my starting point. I initially started mainly looking at what had been happening in the Netherlands, and then there was a strong focus on especially Islam, which makes it interesting for my research focus, because there's not so much, let's say, sub-Saharan African communities aren't problematized based on religion usually. I mean, of course, there's black sub-Saharan Muslims, but they're not necessarily as problematized when it comes to these Hmu nationalist framing. There's a lot of focus on communities from the Middle East, North and Northern African region, and not so much from the sub-Saharan African region. So that's why I thought it was interesting to see how this does affect these communities. The focus, the specific group that I look at in my research. I hope that answers
Thank
your
you.
Question.
Avatala?
So thanks for the questions. Thank you, Jennifer, for the question. It gives me also a chance to elaborate a little bit, because I know talking about, especially Hazan Haida, is very controversial. But I was really trying to think about, you know, when we have a pandemic, and or we think about disease, that these ideas of vulnerability, who is vulnerable, are really contested. And the idea of risk, I know that I've been working as a counselor in a sexual health center. So what people perceive as risky, or who is risky, actually, is so much embedded in power structures and, you know, the systems of power and, you know, race, migration, refugeeness, etc. So I was kind of frustrated, because this is also one of the impulse of me doing this research, that vulnerability was so much connected in German context to age. While at least in the mainstream discourse, other vulnerabilities were not, you know, visible. So things like, you know, a refugee living in a refugee camp who is actually locked down literally in their camp and they cannot move. And that is not seen as a vulnerability. And then also, like, you know, again, of course, I was thinking, and my community is also mostly queer exiles. And like, we are vulnerable in ways that are not seen. There is now a mental health pandemic for us, and there is an exceeding rate of suicide in the community. and it's still happening because we're still living in the post-pandemic world, that is not being addressed as vulnerability. And this idea is where, you know, I was thinking, yes, you have the right, of course, it's very important to be concerned about this virus, but I also have the right to be concerned about so many other things at the same time, including the policing, the militarization, the commercialization of the pandemic, all of those other things. And I think what I want to see forward in, again, thinking about solidarity, is that this this mutual aid, and this, there are a lot of initiatives and groups coming from the queer community particularly, that they wanted to put these values forward. They wanted to actually live out the solidarity and to do mutual aid. And at least for me, what's important is that this idea of like public health doesn't have to be against, you know, pleasure or joy, or at least individual rights, you know, that these things do not have to be in opposition to each other. Just one thing about the, you know, sustainability thing, because I'm coming to this position actually from burnout. I worked for many years as a, you know, as a care worker, and I'm coming to burnout, and now I'm like, okay, I'm coming out into burnout maybe by going into academia. So let's see how that goes. But it's also coming because like this is also important, maybe a moment for me to share that I'm literally I cannot afford academia, but literally the community is paying for my study right now. So this is what I'm saying, like, you know, solidarity, and also like, you know, that there is something circular that goes, especially if you go do care work, and sometimes it's invisible. But yeah, this is a chance to also tell you, if you want to support my bid to go to Glasgow and study there, talk to me, and we'll find some ways to chip in.
Great. Firuze?
I think I talk a lot, particularly about the strategy and tactic to what's the aim of being in academia for me. So for me, it's a kind of the political decision to even come to the social science. I'm a computer engineer, by the way, bachelor. My bachelor is IT, and I decided to change my field completely because I have some questions and I wanted to find answer when I was in Iran. So I completely changed my field and come to social science. I haven't had any idea about how it would be, but yeah, for me, it's a kind of another kind of the field of battleground. So I cannot see it, you know, detached from the activism that I have, but I have no kind of illusion about its limits and, you know, the possibility inside, particularly in North, Global North or whatever. So it's also in tools. Some I'm now use it. Maybe then I found another kind of the battlefield that I feel more fit or kind of more relevant to fight, then I will definitely go there. But I had the chance of in German academia being in the best possible places, at least in Berlin, in BIM, that kind of give me this chance to kind of combine this kind of activism with, you know, producing knowledge. And the other also institute that I'm affiliate currently, Rosa Luxemburg Foundation, that actually they have international research group on authoritarianism and counter strategy that I'm working also is actually based on activism and the activist scholars working. So this, I have this chance of this kind of combine this two possible spaces that I can work. Otherwise, it's not possible. And to be honest, I'm not a good scholar in the sense of publication yet, because I don't have time, I would say that. And I really prioritize what I'm doing for the, you know, the kind of community works that I found that is very important to do. Regarding your question, it's very hard to answer. I don't have a kind of the answer regarding your question. But the things that come my mind is that about my personal situation is that the time I become German, it was at the same time that I realize that I'm in exile. So it's kind of a coincidence. It's supposed not to be like this. So that's why it, for me, it's a kind of more kind of the identity kind of crisis. I never had the illusion of having home when I kind of come out of border of Iran. So I was no sure that I never found a home anymore. But at the same time, this kind of the I also once another kind of panel talk about it, particularly right now, that breathing in one space and kind of living in another space is something that I experienced since at least in the past 9 months, that is also has its own challenging to kind of deal with it. So when because of that, when you talk about the question of hope, for me, hope is actually, it's not about the future ability, more about the potential and the actual, the things that you have in the present. So I'm more into see, and returning to the archive for me is to see what I have in present. So I use, I kind of the inspired by the work of Hannah Arendt, actually, to natality is more important, kind of dealing and fighting for the present rather for the future. So hope is here, exactly here, that you can kind of find it, perhaps.
Very powerful, thank you.
Ay, dur bir dakika, please. Rezana, ondan sonra sen.
The questions, I think the first question about what you're fighting against and what are you fighting for? And I think this is a very important question, the idea of the positionality. And I think that's also changing, right? It's always changing because it depends on the context. And I think, so what I tell myself fighting for is to transform all my lesson learned that I learned from a very painful way, like in terms of like revolutions and counter-revolutions, into a pedagogy, because I'm a teacher. So I want to teach my reflections, my own reflections, of course. So when I teach a course or a syllabus, I reflect on that reading, especially, and also like bring in my experience. And I feel like this is my responsibility, because I claim that one of the reasons why a lot of the revolutions, I don't want to say failed. Maybe you can say failed. Some people might disagree, failed or did not succeed. We can, whatever. But I would say because the older generation did not want to write their experience and lesson learned, so we had to start from scratch. And I think that a lot of the people did not write. There was one writer in Syria I liked, and he wrote about how he was sectarian. And I liked that, because he wrote about how he changed from being sectarian to anti-sectarian, and how that affected his politics later on, because he almost became the president of Syria at one point. He was the vice president of Karam Hourani, the vice president of Jamal Abdel Nasser, when there was a unification between Syria and Egypt. So like reading his diary and how he talks about like, I said this and I did that, but then, and he was the only socialist in Syria who gave the stolen lands back to farmers. He was the only socialist in Syria, but a lot of socialists in Syria, now Assad, of course, is a socialist, and you can see what he's doing. So, I mean, I think that I'm learning from these people how I can reflect from my own mistakes and my own lesson learned and to teach it to students. And write them. I think this is my what I'm fighting for, I guess. What I'm fighting against is a lot, I would say. Racial capitalism, I'm going to the US soon, so I have to like learn about racial capitalism in the US context. I have to learn before I kind of like, I guess if that makes sense. And there was a question about how we can make both work, activism, and academia. Someone said yesterday, community, Fatima, I think was like community, create community. And I think that's my answer is create community that is centering youth. I mean, as someone who's 42 years old, I think I've took enough space and now it's time for the youth to take space.
Thank you so much. So I suggest that we give it to Rüzgar because you were also asked question, and Aysata will close the panel. Okay.
I think about it every day, really. And I think now that I was also really thinking about it, somehow I want to convince myself that we need to own it. And I think this sort of comes sort of, you know, me being travesti and like, you know, what, I mean, no, but it's, I can't really take what people assign to me. You know, I just have to own it myself, or own my body, my life, like, and define it myself. And it's, I really want to hear, acknowledge, you know, the people who paved the way for us, like the people who said, my name is Ausländer, ich arbeite hier, mein Arbeit ist dreckig, mein Arbeit ist schwer. And well, like, we came, like, we came on top of that in a way, but we are also here so long time. I mean, there is a party called Geyhane in Berlin. It's it goes on 25 years. It's a as self definition Oriental queer dance floor, and so it's really like I really think, like, you know, we need to. Now it's on German, like this, making national statements. Allah canceled. No. But it's really like, I also think life is inherently very messy. So, like, there is joy and grief the same day, and it's like, it's the art, like, to learn to live it, to live through it, all of it. And to know it's like, you know, we will die and we will sing together in the funeral. And that's how it is. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much for these words. I think they were beautiful, also last words. And I want to... last words for this panel. And now we can all sing together. No. So thank you for sharing your thoughts and ideas and work. And thank you all for being here. Yeah.
And then we... Thank you very much for on my side too. Now Tuna is gonna give the closing remarks.
Okay, please stay on stage. We only have 5 minutes. It's gonna be a very short closing remarks. I will also be off script following my supervisor. So it is a great pleasure, really. I'm tired, at the same time I'm extremely inspired. So thanks for sharing your work, your practice, your experience. Thanks for sharing what moves you, what motivates you to do what you do. It was really beautiful. I think many of us are leaving this room with ideas, hopefully. We talked about the importance of community. I think community is being built in spaces like this. Although we are in an institutional framework, I think we tried to create the spirit of the feminist and queer of color kitchen table that we were talking about yesterday. That's why the format was conversational rather than presentation. And you made it possible, your input made it possible, our presenters made it possible, so thank you. Just a short note about what will come next. So we didn't record today's sessions, but the voice recording will be transcribed and maybe will be available online. The project will continue. You can find us from any of the websites and all the QR codes. So I would like to name one by one all the panel moderators, because the moderators really put a lot of work. They read the pieces, prepared questions. First of all, engage with the concept. I mean, preparing the concept is one thing, but then the moderators had the difficult role of, like, deciphering what we tried to mean with the panel questions. So for that reason, thank you, Anna Kortevek, Inga Kravchik, Carlos De Kong, and Gökçe Yurdakul, and Aiza Tedrilink, for doing the work and preparing questions.